3, 2, 1. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your hosts, Luke Kim and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take callers, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Welcome, everyone, to the Authority Smashing Hour, another smashing week of shows. And we have Joey today. Are you there, Joey?
Yep, I'm there, man. How you doing?
Pretty good. I didn't think you were going to show up. I was waiting here. But I was glad to see your number there.
Oh, no, I'm good.
Yeah, I just got to see your message. Those seem like interesting topics to cover. But I don't know if you're aware that...
should we give the people the number to the show?
That's right. That's the first thing we should do. Okay, guys, the guest call-in number is 646-716-8106. And I'm going to post that on the chat room so that people can call in if they need to, if they have any questions or whatever. Once again, 646-716-8106. So, I don't know if you guys have heard about the offensive that the Pakistani government has launched in Waziristan, which is right next to Afghanistan. And they, as of now, 48 hours after the initial offensive, apparently there's about 200,000 civilians, 200,000 locals that have been displaced from their homes. But, you know, it's a non-issue among Western newspapers. It's, if it happened to us, even 5,000 displaced would be news. But 200,000 people in that part of the world can be displaced, and we don't care that much. Yeah. So, pretty harsh stuff going on in the Middle East. Of course, increased tensions with Iran because of the the suicide bombing that just went on, by a group which was apparently backed by the United States in some fashion. So, not looking pretty, man. The states of the world are acting like you would expect them to act. Instruments of violence, and and the people still have faith. You know, they have faith in the legitimacy of it. So
yeah, it's something. I think lots of people are finding it ironic, in the sort of normal sense. The ironic that Iran has gotten hit by terrorists, considering, we sort of consider them to be the biggest state sponsor of terrorism around the world. I think lots of the sort of, normal Joes floating around in the U.S. are having a little chuckle that Iran gets a little bit of their own medicine.
Right, right. Well, we know...
What do you make of that?
Well, when you said the thing about terrorism, I couldn't help but to think back at the book, the 1979 book by Chomsky and Herman, The Washington Connection and Third World Fascism. That was my sort of introduction to the intricacies of the term terrorism as it is applied in the ideological system. And basically what they say is that terrorism is, it's always what the enemies do. And normally those enemies are either subnational groups, of course, like Al-Qaeda, like the IRA, whatever. Or if there's an enemy state, like Iraq or Cuba or whatever, then we define what they do as terrorism or sponsors of terrorism or whatever. But it's always the violence of others against our interests that is deemed to be terrorism. Now, this as should be obvious, is not necessarily an indication of whether it is or not. It could be, yeah. It very much is in the case of a lot of these groups, and the root cause of terrorism itself tends to be the actions of nation states. So, for example, in Afghanistan, the Al Qaeda, Mujahideen, whatever you want to call them, they were armed and trained with the CIA, you know, and they also came about as a result of the Russian invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. So the actions of nation states have a decisive effect in creating subnational terrorist groups, and there's no doubt that you know, that's been true throughout history, but that's not the way we look at it. We look at nation states as preventing terrorism, stopping terrorism, not creating it as a sort of institutional status quo. But anyway,
yeah, that's what sort of immediately comes to mind when I hear, people having a laugh that Iran got hit by terrorists. You know, the fact that, Iran got hit by terrorists, and, oh, well, their state sponsors a terrorists and blah, 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 you know, Hezbollah, you know, and those people in Syria, Jordan, Israel, but yeah, like here we are, of course, you know, with the prime example, the most famous example of having created our own terrorists, you know, during the Soviet, during our attempt to, and our successful, you know, our success at turning back the Soviets in Afghanistan, basically because we funded the Mujahideen, you know, and basically, you know, supplied and supported Osama bin Laden, you know, and Al Qaeda itself. So yeah, I think it's more than a little hypocritical that people take some sort of, Schadenfreude here with the Iran terrorist hit.
What I was thinking as well is that these wars and these like a rebellion against these wars or a protest against these wars tend to get people to think about other issues as well. So I remember that my own activism and my own entry into the sort of activist circuit and radical circuit, so to speak, was because of the 9/11 and the war in Iraq, particularly the war in Iraq. And, you know, it's a good first sort of way to start seeing what's wrong with the system. You know, why do we have all these wars? And then people start, you know, questioning other aspects of the system. And I feel that's how a lot of people became radicalized in my generation, and of course prior generations too. You know, of course one can think of the 1960s, which was the sort of stereotypical era where people started becoming more radicalized, more politicized because of the anti-war movement. They started asking questions about the environment they live in.
No doubt. I mean, it's not very hard to see once you get into an anti-war milieu, especially if anarchists have any influence in that, in that scene. Not just this war that's the problem. It's the fact that, you know, the state itself is basically the most, you know, destructive political entity to ever exist, you know, on the planet. I mean, last show you mentioned Eric Fromm, and Fromm, of course, has, you know, the famous book going into just this issue, like how many lives have been lost in the different wars of the modern era. And it's definitely a situation where the nation state is ratcheting up the devastation that it unleashes upon the planet. So, yeah, I mean, given an anti-war milieu and hopefully, you know, anarchist participation in it, you know, people, you know, that aren't exposed to these anarchist ideas are going to, you know, begin to see the light and understand that it's not just, you know, whatever particular war it is, the Afghan war, the Iraq war, Vietnam war, you know, whatever, it's the nation state itself. And then like a more substantive critique could, can come out of that.
Yeah. And I think a reason for that, that some people start to understand is that wars, a big reason why they happen. I mean, one reason, of course, is the greed and you know, resources and stuff. But another one, perhaps deeper, is the subordination to authority, irrational subordination to authority. I was just watching this film called The Egyptian. It's a 1954 film, and there's a scene where someone is asked by the Pharaoh, you know, what's your wish? Do you have a wish? And he said, well, I want to drink the blood of your enemies, you know? And so here's the Pharaoh who's, you know, living God, you know, can hardly get more totalitarian power. And yet the people who are subjected to his power, they want to drink the blood of his enemies. They want to fight his enemies, who are other slaves to other other totalitarian leaders. So there's something irrational about this, but this is most of human history. So, you know, it doesn't really take any genius to question these things, but somehow we just we have this weakness because of our historical circumstances to see the basic flaw in that sort of setup, where we just follow orders from an elite, and we have this irrational attachment to authority. And you know, the wars, all these soldiers, they're obviously following orders, and so are we by providing the everything that's needed for that effort to be implemented. So, yeah.
What's really, you know, to dig a little deeper, I think, is, you know, what with the issue of authority, when the state constitutes itself basically upon a mental sort of, you know, basically it's just a hegemonic operation that's going on, you know, in the minds of the people, but that's the power, you know, that the state is able to draw on. It's able to convince, you know, the everyday person, you know, within its borders, okay, that these conflicts actually have anything to do with these people whatsoever. And so it's able to marshal an obscene amount of force on behalf of the elites, far more force, you know, because of all the people behind it that would normally be wielded. And the nation state itself, you know, coming about in the 15th century or so, 15th, 16th century, really monopolized this power and you know, these systems of control. And you know, the result is, of course, you know, the most ridiculous scale and scope of bloodshed, you know, ever in human history, the last, you know, 500 years or so.
Maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah, I mean,
The difference between the older nation state and the newer nation state, which came about, I guess, around that time. I thought it was a little bit later, but certainly, you know, the modern nation state has some, you know, differences. It's not the same as the older nation state, right?
Sure. I mean, when we think about when we speak about the state, you know, in our current situation, we're talking about specifically the nation state itself, and it's even morphing into something else as we speak anyways. But But yeah, I mean, it's the nation state, and you know, Weber sort of gives us the classic definition of it as that, you know, political entity that claims a monopoly of coercive violence within a defined set of borders. This is different than prior times, because in prior times you had overlapping, competing centers of authority within a specific, you know, region. Mm-hmm. And well, depending, I mean, you know, I'm thinking feudal, but even, you know, even if we think about something like the Roman Empire, how the Roman Empire organized its imperial structure and how it wielded power, it wasn't, it didn't quite act the same way that our nation states do. And so, like, another way to think about the state is the state, you know, on a more sort of simplistic type of level, is that political organization, okay, that is constructed by one class, by a specific class, in order for it to control the other classes. So when we think about the nation state is that specific type of state as defined by Max Weber and elsewhere. There's a good discussion about this on the Anarchist Fact about exactly what a nation state is, what state is.
I think I agree with you in that sense. I would just add that that yes, it's one class controlling another class or other classes, but always from an elite from an elite position. So because I know that the Marxists always say, well, yeah, the state is one class controlling another class, so therefore if the proletariat
exactly.
get to control
I'm going back to that sort of a definition, yeah.
Right. So, yeah, just that little
which is again, it's a far more simplistic notion, I think, of what the state is. I think anarchists have a far better developed notion of the state and how it operates than Marxists. I mean, I think that's for obvious reasons. But yeah, so if we think about the state in those terms, then there have been states that have existed for a long time. I mean, you know, the Greek city-states, the Roman state, you know, going out east, the Chinese, you know, imperial state, etc. So it's, but those states are intrinsically different than the sort of state that we confront now and that we have been confronting for the last essentially 500 years. So, I mean, basically what happens in the 15th, 16th century is that's about, you know, that's when you start to get, you know, really the sort of upheavals that happened, you know, basically to install absolutist monarchy. So we move through different stages of the nation state, you know, from absolutist state to the state we have now.
I don't know why that I thought that the rise of the modern nation state was a little bit later, more sort of coinciding with the rise of the bourgeoisie.
Exactly. That's a pretty traditional sort of Marxist type of take on it. Because, of course, when we get to the French Revolution, and it's important to distinguish the intrinsic differences between the French Revolution and the American Revolution. The reason why the American Revolution, you know, doesn't count, okay, in this situation is the simple fact that the same class was in power. So when we look at it from the perspective of the left, you know, George Washington, John Adams, all those people, they were basically the same exact type of people that were ruling us before. But when we go over to the French situation, the French Revolution, you have the bourgeois revolution. And so you have the ushering in, you go from an absolutist state to a bourgeois state, and that is, you know, basically what the left has been in opposition to, you know, for the last, you know, what is it now, 200 some odd years.
Well, I
but
guess...
yeah, that's where the whole idea of, like, the class, the state is the system, you know, the political system that one class uses to oppress others. And you can go all the way back in ancient history when you had priests, you know, unfolding their system of governance, you know, on the people, et cetera, et cetera. So when we look at it through that sort of class lens, we see states all the time. And like you said, they are definitely going to be governed by an elite caste of people within that class, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, so I think we have a far better understanding of what the state is, you know, in the sort of sociological era, beginning with like Max Weber, et cetera, than we did probably before.
Since we're on that vein of discussing the historical aspects of it, maybe we can discuss how, you know, because we've seen the development of the merchant class, the capitalist class, the bourgeoisie, whatever you want to call it, and the United States, which is one of the most business influenced societies in history, we've seen the rise of people, especially within the merchant class, who were opposed to the state. And that's unusual in the sense that, or at least they claim to be against the state. And that's unusual because the history of capitalism and the state is a mutually sort of dependent history, in the sense that they've always been together. And it seems to me that especially big business, that's always relied on the power of the state to defend its property, to pass laws that would be beneficial to its to its hegemony and profit. And maybe one theory is that the petit bourgeois or small business or middle-sized business, they were a little more radical, sort of radical capitalists, in the sense that they were more against the state, because they were not getting such a big piece of the action. So they were saying, well, you know, the government is not working for our interest. They're working for the big guy's interest. So it would be better off if we got rid of the state. But that's just because they're not up in the hierarchy of businesses. Do you see any validity to that?
Absolutely zero validity to that at all. There is a massive delusion in the U.S. especially. The idea that, you know, the petit bourgeois, okay, if we're going to deploy those terms, are anti-state. I don't think that's the case at all. I think that delusion is sort of born, especially in our current situation, out of this idea that, you know, and you hear this all the time on you know, right-wing talk radio, et cetera, like my buddy Glenn Beck, you know, limited government, we don't want the state, you know, the small businessman just wants, you know, the government to get out of the way and blah, blah, blah. And they always go back to the founders of this country, okay, to authorize that point of view. And that is an utterly ridiculous read, okay, on the history of the founding of the country, and especially the Constitution. The founders were for the state because they knew that they could wield the state on their behalf, okay, to do all sorts of things within the country and without the country that they didn't have very good support for. And for this, you can look to Howard Zinn's history. But there's another really good history book about this. It's by a guy named Jerry Freesia, Freesia. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book in the late 80s called Toward an American Revolution, Exposing the Constitution and Other Illusions. And it's a very, very good read. It's obviously going to be contested, etc. It's a very good read in the sense that it sort of decodes what the founders were trying to do. We can look elsewhere, too. Like, for instance, when we think about the petit bourgeois and, like, their sort of political allegiances, there was, I don't know how many people in our audience or you, if you're familiar with the Paris Commune in 1871.
Yeah.
So in the Paris Commune, and this is something that was written about, you know, extensively after the fact by Marxists and anarchists. Bakunin wrote about it, Kropotkin, Marx, of course, Engels,
okay,
all these people, even getting down to Lenin and Mao. So in 1871, basically, the workers of Paris, this is right after the Franco-Prussian War, took over Paris. They had the National Guard on their side, a National Guard regiment, took over Paris itself, and basically took control and ran Paris for 2 months. They had, you know, worker councils, and basically set up or tried to, as best they could, egalitarian solutions. Now, they had problems, you know, not the least of which was their own internal organizations, et cetera, and the fact that they were being bombarded every day. Long story short, though, the upper bourgeois and, of course, the elites running the government fled Paris when this happened in early in March of 1871. But the petit bourgeois basically just sort of stood around and waited to see who was going to win, you know, and then, you know, just the vast majority of them stayed in Paris, okay?
Can you mention
really
the book again?
Per se,
can you talk about that? Can you actually mention the book again for the audience? Hello?
Yeah, the book on the American situation, the American Revolution, it's called Toward an American Revolution, : Exposing the Constitution and Other Illusions.
I made that.
And that's by Jerry Frisia. And it's a very cool book as far as like what it does to the founders, how it compares the Articles of Confederation versus the Constitution, what the differences are, why the founders decided to make the Constitution versus keeping the Articles of Confederation, which were extremely popular, according to Frisia anyway.
I may add, in that regard, that when I interviewed Thomas Ferguson of University of Massachusetts, he spoke about those two issues, and he recommended a book, which I forget the name now, but it's actually on my documentary. I showed it on my documentary, sort of a guy that talks about the founding fathers and their wealth. But we also spoke about small business in the context of the New Deal. This 1930s, of course.
Yeah.
And what he said was that the small businesses, there was a fair amount of support for Roosevelt. That is that, you know, there's a lot of, he told me there was a lot of propaganda that the small business guys were opposed to the New Deal. They were more right-wing or whatever, but it turns out that actually weren't. And the reason for that is because they were not getting such a big piece of the action, some of the other guys, especially in the more labor-intensive industries. And therefore, they were sort of desperate, and so they were in favor, you know, they were in favor of being protected by a sort of welfare state. So that was another, you know. So, but yeah, I think that I would agree with you that the role of the petit bourgeois has always been a sort of an opportunist role.
Pretty much, yeah.
Anyway, we have a caller here, so maybe we can see who this is. Hello, are you there? Is this hello? I don't know if that's a caller. Hello, sir, caller. Well, we have a number here, but nobody's on the other side. So, well, if you guys want to call,
they might just be listening in on the phone.
No, but because they're calling. So I'm not sure if it's a 917 number. Which is it? Boston? Is Boston 917? I don't know.
I have the foggiest clue. But yeah, I mean, basically, you're right. I mean, getting back to our discussion about the you know, about the role of the petty bourgeois, they really are sort of the opportunists. I mean, they have always served a mediating type of role between the proletariat proper and, you know, and capitalism itself. I mean, there are many times where, you know, you find them you know, playing both sides of the fence, depending on who's in power, what they can get out of it. I mean, basically like anybody, but I would basically classify them as a sort of non-ideological class, like, you know, people that aren't intrinsically invested in things. They can be marshaled to be invested, but as far as, like, you know, what they as a class are under sort of neutral circumstances, I think they're non-ideological. Whereas, of course, the capitalist class and the proletariat would be overtly ideological.
Well, I guess what I would, I don't know if I agree, because most of the small business guys that I've met, they tend to be, they were very supportive of Obama and maybe they have, yeah, U.S. flags on their displayed, and so, oh, I mean, sure, they it's not, they don't go out of their way, but they are sort of, they try to fit in within the ideological atmosphere in which they find themselves.
Pretty because that's exactly the way, right.
You know, it's funny you say that, because in fact I remember that I was talking to this Arab guy who has a store here, and the guy had, like, I swear to God, like 10 U.S. flags on the store, and I was sort of and I was laughing, and I said, you know, I know why you have all those flags. And I mean, it turns out the guy does not support the U.S. at all. I mean, he was very critical when he understood where I was coming from. He was very critical of the U.S. But yeah, because he has to fit in, because he has a business where he has to sell stuff, he's like, oh, you know, this guy, oh, sure, you know, he appreciates this country, you know, look at those flags, right? So anyway, I guess
if we put like a whole bunch of American flags around our info shop, we get more people to come in.
Right, at least 20 of them, 30. Anyway, I guess we can play a little bit of something here, because it's time for a break. So let's play Oaxaca song. All right. Song by, I don't know who the band is, but it just says Oaxaca song. And as you guys know, there was there's been a lot of stuff, a lot of revolts in Oaxaca a few years ago, if I remember well. There were some teacher struggles down there, and people got killed and everything. So anyway, let me see if this person is still here waiting or what. Excuse me, sir. Hello? Is this a caller? Hello? Well, I guess not. You there, Joey?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah. Hey, if anybody does want to call in, the number is 646-716-8106. 646-716-8106.
That's it. So, yeah, I guess maybe what I could do just for people who are, you know, like want to know what maybe a union action looks for, I mean, looks like, I'm going to read a little short story of some nurses, which I think is, you know, sort of kind of inspiring. It says, on September 2004, the nurses on a medical surgical ward at UCLA Medical Center told management they would care for no more than 6 patients at a time. To do so, they explained, would violate a law and jeopardize patient safety. When management threatened to discipline them, the nurses told management they couldn't be forced to break the law. They called in their union reps, who were waiting outside the hospital. The reps backed the rank and filers up, even when management called the police to throw them out. During a 4-hour confrontation, nurses refused to accept unsafe assignments. Union reps stood their ground, management fumed, and the police scratched their heads. Finally, management was forced to hire temp nurses to care for all the patients. Quote, we caught them completely off guard, says Solis, which I guess is the union member. All of a sudden, they were not in control. The nurses were in control, and that drove management up the wall. Meanwhile, the union members were leafleting nurses on other shifts at other hospitals, letting them know about the campaigns at UCLA Hospital. Soon, more wards there and at LA County USC Medical Center were refusing unsafe assignments. And as this book was being completed, management had been forced to staff within the ratios or close to them, but only on the floors where nurses had demanded their rights. What's more, the union member says that the nurses' success led them to question other safety hazards. Quote, nurses are looking into what needles are being used on a ward, asking, are they safe? Nurses are checking out ergonomics, looking into things they never had the courage to question management about before. Anyway, so I just thought that was a little story, which just shows that you know, things don't have to be the way they are. You can improve things at the workplace, and you know, and very often, collective action, doing things with others, can lead to improvements. So, just a little story there.
Hello? What was the union that organized that? Was it the American Nurses Association?
I think it was SEIU. I don't know if you heard
SEIU?
About
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know SEIU. We've got some people affiliated with our info shop that work for SEIU and work for the Ohio Nurses Association. It's interesting. I mean,
yeah, you know,
it's not just for the nurses though. You see, like that's the key. Like, it's also to increase the quality of patient care. You know, the less patients that each nurse has to worry about, the more attention each nurse can give to each patient as well, which is probably why that law is in effect at all. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, it's one of those instances where it's not, you know, just, you know, sort of selfish sort of thing, you know, that the nurses are doing, blah, 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 that you're going to hear all the union busters talk about. But it has to do with the fact not only for the nurses, but also for the patients to increase their quality of care.
I may point
so
out.
Goes together.
I may point out as well that another thing that sort of shows the exploitation of the capitalist workplace is a union technique called rule to work. In other words, you do exactly as you're supposed to do, no more, no less, and so which means you slow down the work pace because normally you're always expected to do more than what the rules say. So if by following the rules you actually slow down the pace of work, and you yeah. and you're considered to not be doing your job, that right there shows you that I mean, sort of like a lot of these free market people say, hey, you know, it's totally voluntary, and you're, I mean, the presence of a supervisor, someone who's speeding you up, trying to extract as much labor as he can from you, that's one important aspect of it. So I mean, that is sort of exposed in the right to work a strategy where you slow down work to the level where it's required from you.
Yeah, it's work to the rule.
Yeah, that's right.
Work to the rule. Yeah, work to the rule is a common union strategy. It was employed, you know, actually recently in town with the instructors at our community college. They did work to the rule, which of course shut down the school newspaper, shut down all these other, you know, things that are, you know, sort of the normal working of a college. But yeah, I don't know. I'm sort of dubious about work to the rule as a strategy. I think it's got to be deployed in the right circumstances. Otherwise, it's not very effective. But hey, you know, whatever people think they need to do, I would of course, you know, opt for more radical tactics.
All right, but maybe one, you know, like one thing leads to the next. It's sort of like, you know, it's very hard to create confidence to, because I mean everyone's afraid. I mean, you enter the job. I mean, you're already accepting the job most likely because you're afraid of not having a job. Yeah, you're afraid of your insecurity. You're insecure. So I mean, the whole environment is one of fear. So in order to overcome that fear, it's you know, it's you have to build confidence and get to know others, and it's tough, you know, it really is a tough battle. But anyway, so just wanted to talk about a little bit about that. So anyway, I know you sent me an email. Was that?
Yeah, I think that leads nicely, you know, into thinking about EFCA, the Employee Free Choice Act, which is sort of languishing now in the U.S. Congress, and. I don't know. I was listening to Michael Savage as I'm wont to do on my way back from work. Sometimes I'm sorry. I can't get enough of, like, you know, rabid right wing radio. It's it's awesome. It's addictive. It's addictive.
Yeah, it is.
But yeah. So Michael Savage had a guy on who was ranting and raving about you know, the Employee Free Choice Act, how it's going to destroy businesses, et cetera, et cetera. And, but yeah, I just wanted to alert people that that's still an issue. That's still something that, you know, we need to, agitate for, to make it far more, feasible to organize. We're on campus ourselves, you know, we're trying to organize, a graduate employee union, and, there's like massive hurdles in place, you know, not the least of which is, the issue that we can't just sort of do a card check. So, you know, this is something that, you know, we have to agitate for. If you're in the U.S., you should definitely get in touch with your legislators and tell them that, you know, you support EFCA, et cetera. It's a pretty important issue. It came up in the news again because there was a Republican councilwoman in New York who is trying to run for Congress, and she has sort of thrown her support behind EFCA. And needless to say, this has roused the ire of, you know, of Republicans and right wingers. Hence, you know, Michael Savage's show. But you know, it's funny. Like the discourse, I always find the discourse of, you know, unions, how they destroy companies, extremely amusing in their just utter and complete duplicitousness. They're constantly trying to turn the working class against each other, whereas, you know, and subvert solidarity, and that's like just a basic strategy they have. But it's often, you know, oh, well, the companies aren't going to make enough money, and so they're going to have to close the doors. And at which point, you know, a wise person would ask, well, why are they going to close the doors if the company is still running, still able to pay its workers, et cetera, et cetera? Well, it's going to close the doors because it's not going to be lining the pockets, okay, of the capitalist scum who don't do any freaking work as much as they want it to.
Also, I mean, I think the two traditional ways of countering that, of course, is the first is sort of like the more conservative way of countering that argument is that, well, you know, the workers are also consumers. So if the workers get paid more, it may hurt the individual company, but in the long run, it helps everyone because aggregate demand increases so they can buy more stuff, so they can buy the products the capitalist is selling. So that's the conservative argument. The other argument is that that's not an argument against unions. It's an argument against capitalism because basically what they're saying is, look, unions are making us uncompetitive. And you can say that even if no – let's say there were no unions in the United – not a single union, right? But one workplace unionized, they could claim, well, I'm at a competitive disadvantage as to somebody else. In other words, yeah, certainly, if you can have workers that are not unionized, the likelihood is you're going to be at a competitive advantage. So what does that tell you? Well, that's not an indictment against unions. It's an indictment against capitalism, because if you can't allow workers to organize themselves to have a sort of some sort of say at the workplace, if that's what's demanded from your economy, that's an indictment against capitalism. I mean, and that is sort of like when people discuss these things about competitiveness, which is sort of almost a religious concept where, oh, you know, we have to respect this stuff. You know, we have to think, well, look, what about these other values? And that's what's not being talked about. So,
well, it really just sort of reveals, in full daylight, the fact that capitalism is a system that runs best on exploiting people, not giving them a say, being totalitarian, being autocratic at the workplace. I think that basically says it all. I can't envision, you know, anybody who thinks even the slightest bit with clarity, okay, could back a system, okay, that refuses, okay, universally to give people a say in their lives. What is that? That's nonsense. That is, you know, the greatest oppression right there. And, you know, insofar as a union does that, and it is that organ, you know, it serves one of the most fundamental purposes of, you know, our society, and that is giving workers a say, period.
Right.
It's mind-boggling to me.
I think that the reason why they don't. I mean, it's very hard to look at yourself and think I'm an exploiter. So they've created. I mean, the whole of economic theory, you know, the theory of marginalism and all that stuff, is about sort of justifying the status quo by, you know, emphasizing subjective personal choice. You know, I mean, and emphasizing the voluntary nature of work and emphasizing how wages reflect some sort of like fair. You know, marginal you know, quantity or something. It's all a big scheme, really, to justify these exploitative practices in the minds of the people who are in control of the means of production. That's what most of it is. And for those who are interested in actually finding understanding these issues. There's a very good author. His name is Steve Keen, who's a sort of post-Keynesian economist who's got a pretty good knowledge of Marx too, and he debunks neoclassical economics. He's got a good book called Debunking Economics. He talks about all these issues, and you know that's what it comes down to, that they can't admit. Well, you know,
debunk neoclassical or neoliberal economics.
No, neoclassical. Yeah,
okay, all right.
Yeah, the whole school of marginalism, the whole school of,
yeah,
you know,
okay.
all those indifference curves and all that stuff. I mean, it's pretty pretty silly stuff. But anyway, you sent me an email earlier about people that call me Mr. 1001 Bolsheviks, which is, I mean, these are the free market capitalists who call me this.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I think it's funny. I mean, I wanted to just address that as best and most succinctly as I could during this time. Maybe we'll pick up with it next time, but I think the reason why, of course, they're saying that is because, you're a strong advocate of sort of reformism in sort of anarchist, in anarchist theory. So you advocate sort of reformist tactics, et cetera. And I mean, there is a sense where reformism does end up looking like
social
in
democracy,
the short term, anyways.
Yeah. Huh? Like social democracy, sort of. Yeah.
Yeah, like social democracy, basically. Yeah, and in that sense, like, it's also like this very gradualist approach to things, and so when Chomsky, for instance, says stuff like we have to get what we can from the state, push the state to its limits, et cetera, until it collapses, like that sort of notion. It's got this, this vague sort of Marxist echo for people where, Marx, of course, envisioned the withering away of the state.
Right.
At the later stages of socialism, till we get, to communism itself. So I think that's where they're sort of, going, with it. I just think that it's extremely misinformed.
I think it's also, I think also it has to do, I mean, when you talk about the withering away of the state in Marxist theory, they can always say, well, look at the, it was tried at that, look at the Soviet Union, the state never withered away. But was it, I mean, did the Soviet Union have democratic councils that were pushing for the dissolution of the state? No, right. I mean, you had an autocratic state, and so the question is whether or not passing some of these reformist measures, will in fact help the working class. I mean, I think that.
Well, I mean, if we just go back to Bolshevik history itself, they were. The Soviet Union was essentially Soviets were worker councils, okay?
Yep,
and so, when we think about them in that very neutralized term, they were basically council communism. This is why Luxembourg and people like that got on board. This is why Emma Goldman was excited about it, because they were like, oh my gosh, well, we took the reins of power from the Tsar, et cetera, so now we can institute some sort of, worker council form of governance, right? Of course, that's not how it played out, because the Bolsheviks and Lenin were in power, and one of the first things they did was take over all the worker councils, make it so basically the worker councils were composed of the Bolshevik Communist Party, and utterly neutralized and neutered the democratic process. I mean, basically, what you had in the Soviet Union was one party less than what you have in the U.S.
Coming from a feudal background as well, right? I mean,
it's very bizarre to do that. I mean, the Bolsheviks went after unionists. Trotsky went after Makhno in the Ukraine, and lots of people don't realize that the Ukraine, around the time of the Russian Civil War in the mid-19-teens, was run basically for 2 years by anarchists and protected by Makhno's Black Army. The Red Army was deployed on them, and they didn't want the anarchist rot to spread. They cracked down the Kronstadt Rebellion. There's so many instances where the Bolsheviks, okay,
directly under the control of Lenin himself, went after specifically those democratic workplace practices that basically formed the ground for installing them. And this goes all the way back into Lenin's own writings. And when we think about Leninism and its relationship to the libertarian left, we have to be extremely reticent when we make alliances, et cetera, with these people, because their views on how to carry out a revolution, a proletarian revolution, a worker liberation, definitely diverge from ours. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, what I was going to say is that, like Michael Albert has spoken about how, in capitalism you have all these different classes, but one of the class that sort of stands between the workers and the owners, the capitalists, is a managerial class. And
yeah.
he thought that the managerial class was they were the natural sort of state bureaucrats, the natural state elite, because they despise the capitalists on the one hand because they have power over them, and on the other hand they still want to rule over the workers like they usually do as managers. So they're right in between, and they're opportunists as well, because they would like to gain more power, which sort of like reminds me a little bit to what we were talking about earlier about the petit bourgeois, because they're also opportunists in their own way. Right.
It's interesting. I think it's very important for everybody that identifies with the left and red politics in general to read people like Lenin. And yes, even anarchists should read someone like Lenin, because there are important ideas there, let alone important historical connections across, the left movement that are extremely important to interrogate. I think, maybe next time I can delve into more of that stuff. I think it'd be fun to talk specifically about Lenin, especially considering that this is the month of October, and the Bolshevik Revolution is also known as the October Revolution.
That's
so
right.
So maybe we could talk about that next time, next Tuesday. And why don't you play us out, and we're about to wind things down.
So which song did you want to play? You told me about Muse, right?
I want to do Uprising. I like Uprising.
All right, man. Well, let's finish off with Uprising if I can find it here. And where's this thing? Okay, here it is. Well, thanks, Joey, man, and I'll see you next week then. Feel free to call in anytime. All right. Thank you, listeners. Right. Talk to you later. Bye. All right.
Second.
10 seconds.
I think a switch and I'll predict that I feel it. We should never.